Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. I'm Josh Beiser. We got a great cast for you tonight. My guest is from the studio Rage Squid. Please welcome to the cast, coder Rule Ezedam.
Hello there.
Hi, Rule. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, for people who aren't familiar with the studio, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what Rage Squid is?
So I am Roel Ezedam. I'm one of the founders of the studio Rage Squid, and we are a Dutch game studio. So we're based in the center of the Netherlands, and we're sort of a starting game company, and we've been making games for quite a long time. Actually, we're just a group of friends, mm-hmm. and about a good year ago we started working on our sort of debut title, which is Action Hank.
And Action Hank, for those of you who haven't played it, is similar to a speedrunner or a platformer, sort of like the Bit.Trip series or even Trials, but it's more based around physics and platforming compared to those titles.
Yeah, it's I guess the best comparison you could make to if you had to compare it to any other game would be Trials. But it's without a bike, but it's with a sort of a running guy. And it's this, the game is about this action figure who's sort of in a midlife crisis. He used to be really cool back in the 80s and 90s. He was this really cool action figure. And now he's grown old and he's sitting on the couch all day. And he's sort of like, he gained some weight. And then he gets challenged by this sort of rival. And he wants to prove that he's still the fastest out there. And that's basically what the whole game is about. Just, you have all these levels and you just have to go through them as quickly as possible. And that's very similar to any game like Trials or Trackmania or that mm-hmm. those kinds of games.
Yep. Now, one interesting part about Action Hank is that it is more physics involved compared to games like Trials or other speedrunning games, as your momentum is a big part of the game. Could you talk a little bit more about sort of developing the physics for Action Hank?
All right. So, the reason that the whole game is so much oriented about physics and momentum is simply because I really enjoy making that. So I'm really into game design, but also into game physics. So I really like to combine those. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Action Hank, you can see that that's basically the entire core of the game. It's just about managing the physics and understanding all the sort of subtle little tricks that you have to pull off to maximize your momentum. And then keeping your momentum makes you, improve your time. But you can, if you keep the velocity, you can do this other jump also faster, which makes you go even more faster. So it's all about just maintaining the momentum, and that was in terms of game design, that was just the whole challenge to try and get all these sort of movement variables together, and they're all based on sort of friction and acceleration. And it's like, if you run, you have this much acceleration, and if you slide, you have no acceleration, but you have less friction, but the gravity pulls you down. So it's just like, it was mainly coming up with all these variables and tweaking them until they also felt to sort of coherent and intuitive, but also that they couldn't be exploited to have this sort of superior tactic that would break all the strategy. So there was still need for some sort of more subtle mechanics that are not clear from the start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from what I play, I just went through the first group of levels before the cast. You have situations where you have to, go around loop-de-loops, there's wall jumping involved, and part of the challenge of the game is that you're racing against the clock, and you can set up a ghost that plays the game either on easy, medium, or hard setting, and when you're watching, the gold or the hardest ghost go through, it tries to play very optimally. And it's up to you to sort of match that and really beat it in order to get the best time for the level.
Yeah, so the ghost is sort of... So the original idea when we came up with the game is we weren't really planning on doing online multiplayer. In the end, we're adding it. Mm-hmm. But we were not planning on that at the start. So, but we wanted to have this way for people to sort of compete against each other. So that's why we came up with this idea of that you can upload your ghost data and then race each other. And then we thought, well, oh, that's actually a nice thing if you can combine that with sort of racing against the bronze, silver, and gold medals. And there, these medals are just a really good way for people to find a challenge up to their standards. Mm-hmm. Because some people, they are having a hard time already beating the bronze medal.
Yeah.
So they feel really rewarded if they actually beat the level and beat the bronze time. Whereas other people are like, yeah, I'm not going to go for anything less than gold. I'm not even going to try. So they go instantly to the gold medal and they want to beat the gold ghost. And that just, it's really cool because you have this level which is sort of simple, just because the levels, especially earlier on, tend to be really easy. They tend to be, they're built in a way that you sort of, no matter how good you are, you always feel like everything is going really well and all the jumps are spaced in a way that you can always sort of land nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But getting this good time requires more knowledge of the game mechanics. So that way these ghosts not also provide you with sort of, with a challenge that you can scale up yourself to your liking,
mm-hmm.
but it's also a way for people to sort of subtly, show them more intricate game mechanics. Because so especially if you start looking at the sort of harder ghosts, the gold one, and there's even when you beat the gold medal, there's a rainbow medal you can get, which is even harder, which is like a sort of near perfect medal to beat.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start looking at these medals, you can really see sort of, if you look closely and you pay attention, you can see the more subtle moves they pull off. But you have to look closely. So people are really, that really want to get better, they will, you know, start observing them and they'll be like, oh, wait, oh, he jumps earlier there, or oh, he does a slide there instead of a run. And so that way the ghosts will also sort of intuitively teach the players what to do without having to hold their hands and to sort of show like all these tutorials and be like, yeah, you don't have to, you shouldn't do this, or you have to do it, and like pause the game. And we don't want that. We want it to be like really subtle in the background.
Yeah. Now, when you guys were developing the ghosts for the different levels, was this something that, like, you guys played yourselves and, you know, just record yourselves playing? Or did you just, like, let the AI play the game itself to get the different bronze, silver, gold, and rainbow runs?
So all the ghosts, so the nice thing was, because we already had the system of having to record ghosts because we wanted, you know, friends to be able to challenge each other,
mm-hmm.
We already built this system of, you know, when you play a level, it records your ghost. So we just use that system to record all the ghosts for the bronze and the silver and the gold. But the tricky thing is that if you want to, I mean, it's really hard to be bad at your own game, because
yeah.
it's a really common problem. If you make a game, you it's really easy to fall into the trap of making it way too hard, because you're getting really good at it and you're like, well, this is really easy for me. So I tried, when I was recording all the ghosts, I tried to set like sort of standards, like these are the actions that I should be allowed to pull off when I'm recording such a ghost, and these are the actions that I shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the more subtle stuff. And then especially, you know, a bronze medal has to really sort of screw up all the time. But a regular player will usually sort of do okay throughout the level and then screw up big time in one moment. But you don't want the ghost to do that, because it gives a really bad sort of, you want to sort of, when you record the bronze medal, you have to consistently screw up everything a bit rather than screwing up really bad ones. So it was quite the challenge, and it still is, because it's actually really hard to come up with a proper difficulty curve for your game.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the levels, they get harder to beat, and then the ghosts get harder to beat as well. So we have to find a balance in that. And it's mainly, we use statistics to see if there are certain levels that are sort of, that are certain medals or levels that are sticking out in terms of percentage of people who beat them. So we can see, oh, this medal is actually too hard or too easy.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's just, it's quite the challenge to come up with this sort of slowly increasing difficulty curve without just,
mm-hmm.
completely screwing it up.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the actual game mechanics themselves, right now in the game, you have the run, slide, jump, and then there's advanced maneuvers like wall jumping and the loops. Are there any other like new mechanics or systems that you guys are playing that hasn't been implemented yet, or is the foundation basically set for Action Hank?
So I think the strength of Action Hank is the really simple foundation.
Mm-hmm.
There is a grappling hook pickup, which you can pick up in a later stage of the game, but those are sort of levels specifically built for the grappling hook.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that kind of, you know, throws things around. But still, it's the grappling hook is still in combination with the regular game mechanics. But I definitely think that's sort of the strong point of the game, that it's such a simple core.
Mm-hmm.
Because we really want the players to understand the game mechanics after the first level. And, you know, this first level takes 20 seconds or less, or around 20 seconds. So we want the players to sort of, like, they start walking and then they jump and then they sort of get this little information thing on how to slide. They see it in the background and then they slide downhill, and then we want them to understand the whole game. Like, oh, this is all that I do. And we want them to be really happy about it. Like, we want it to feel really good. So people are like, nice. And they want to just continue. And then throughout the game, they realize that there's a lot more to it, and that they just sort of, they start mastering the mechanics. So we really want the players to master these simple mechanics rather than just continuously expose them to new mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was checking out the Rage Squid site, and you said earlier that Action Hank is one of your studio's first games. I see you guys have also done several Game Jam titles before then. In terms of actually starting Action Hank, where did the design of the game originally come from?
Let me see. That's a while back. So, as you said, we did a lot of Game Jam projects. Like I said earlier, we're just a group of friends and we know each other from sort of game development university.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just started making games together. And, you know, that's just how that goes in school. You form mm-hmm. groups and then people join and people go. And then you sort of end up, we kind of ended up with a couple people, and we were like, hey, we really got this sort of motivation or ambition to start our own game studio. So we really wanted to do that. And when we do game jams, we tend to come up with ideas that are not really viable for, you know, commercially.
Mm-hmm.
So we usually do stuff like local multiplayer games and just like really fun little party games. So I'm not saying it's impossible to make money on that, but it's really hard to, you know, to make a commercially viable local multiplayer game.
Mm-hmm.
So we set out to do something, like to come up with a concept that was sort of built around making it sort of commercially viable from the beginning, or at least a project that was built to be a whole big project rather than a 48-hour thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's when we sort of came up with Action Hank, but that was, I think, in late 2012. So that was a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made this prototype for it, and we showed it at a conference. And people are really enjoying it, and it seemed like this was really, like, this concept had a lot of potential. So we wanted to start working on it, but we didn't really have the sort of the resources to actually start working on it or to spend a lot of time on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it took around a year before we actually started working on it. And in this year, it's people were sort of graduating and other people doing freelance work to sort of save up money. And so around a year, we had this situation where it was suddenly was like, hey, this is a good time. We have the money now to work for a good half a year, and everything was sort of came together. We had the concept, and we already sort of evolved the concept for a year because we couldn't work on it. We were just sort of mm-hmm. thinking about it and discussing it. So we had, you know, the concept had some time to sort of evolve. And then late 2013, I think in November, we started working on it. And then, yeah, we just started. We just like, yeah, I guess we just have to start now and we'll see where it goes. And then about 8 months later, we were really starting to run out of money. And we knew that we didn't have a lot of money. So we were definitely looking into all the options that we could go for. And then one of them that seemed the best for us at the time was doing early access. So that's when we launched the game on Steam Early Access around July.
Mm-hmm.
And the income of the Early Access sort of allows us to keep going. And, you know, like you can pay for the office, and it's like small beginnings, but at least it allows us to finish the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, it's lucky for us because we don't spend a lot of money. We're still this sort of, you know, like student attitude, and we don't mm-hmm. need much. We just want to make games. And
mm-hmm.
and now it's sort of, it's finally coming to an end. And in about a month, month or two, we want to, you know, release the game. And as we speak, we're basically wrapping up all kinds of final things.
Okay. And I'm glad you brought up Early Access World, because we hear from a lot of developers about their perceptions of the Early Access program. And there's definitely a difference between either older developers who have moved from retail who are doing Early Access to new indie studios who are starting from Early Access. For you guys at Rage Squid, what are your thoughts on the whole Early Access model when it comes to game development?
Let me think. Let's see. It's what you say. It's true. There's definitely sort of a really diverse reaction on Early Access, and also from the sort of the consumers. People tend to be pretty negative about Early Access, and I really understand why,
mm-hmm.
because people can, you know, if they get ripped off a couple of times, they tend to be, you know, really bitter about it. So the way we tried to approach Early Access was to have a product that's absolutely stable, even though it's still small.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as far as I know, people have, you know, what I heard from people is that they, in our case, they have really been enjoying the game, and they're like, yeah, this is how you're supposed to do it. Mm-hmm. The game works, it's robust, it's still small, but in a couple of weeks there will be an update with more content, but the game already works, and it's mm-hmm. not like this broken thing that's sort of held together by duct tape that's sort of, you know, so because we knew about how critical, you know, how annoyed people were by Early Access and these games that are so early that they just fall apart. So we said, okay, we keep it small and robust. So, and I think that should be the way to go, I guess. It's always a hard thing, because obviously when you buy Early Access, you're going to buy an unfinished product, and you should buy it because you want to be involved in the development. But mm-hmm. still, it's a lot of games tend to get really hyped, and so people are really like, yeah, I want to try it out. And then people are really bad at seeing how the game will actually be if they just see a release trailer, right? So mm-hmm. they will buy it, and then they'll see, oh, wait, everything is broken, and then they feel really ripped off. So I think it's something you have to be sort of careful about as a developer. And it's also, I mean, it also depends on what kind of game you're making. Mm-hmm. So, but the sort of the feedback that you get from your community, and sort of this, the amount of, you know, the amount of broken stuff that we were able to fix because of all these people providing feedback is enormous. So that's not necessarily, I mean, you can also do a beta program. So this thing of having a community that already gets early access to your game, whether they have to pay for it or not, is something I would probably do in the next project as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't know about early access itself, because for us it was also sort of a financial decision, because we basically had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I really like most about it is just being able to spot all these little errors, because you have so many people playing the game, you're just bound to run into more problems or, you know, like loose ends that you didn't see yourself. So that's something I would definitely do again in the next project.
Yep, and you're not alone with that rule. We hear this from a lot of developers who have moved to Early Access, and they say the same thing. They love having essentially a huge pool of alpha and beta testers who are poring over their game, making sure, you know, to catch all the little bugs, all the little mistakes that you wouldn't have known about until the game was actually released.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, for Action Hank in Early Access, you talked about how you guys wanted to get the foundation of the game, you know, solid before putting it on Early Access. Was the decision to put on Early Access, you know, like an immediate one as soon as you had something playable? Or did you spend time working on the alpha before actually releasing it on Early Access?
So, I mean, we definitely spent, I guess, the first version, like the first playable version we had of the game was actually after 1 month of development. We did a sort of a web build that mm-hmm. we showed around to people. And if you look back, well, it looks pretty ugly now, but the core of the game is already in there, apart from the grappling hook, I guess. But if you look at the sort of the actual physics of the game, the core motion, which is basically what the whole game is about, it hasn't really changed much since the first month or two. And that's also the way we try to set it up. We try to set it up in such a solid and simple way that it doesn't need to be changed all the time. Mm-hmm. So basically after about a month or two, the core of the game was there. And then we spent about, I think, 6 months before we actually released on early access. So we definitely put some time, like we wanted to have a proper playable version of the game before we released on early access.
Okay. Now, since Action Hang is, all, as we said, is your studio's like first full game, and this is also your first game actually on Steam, I was just wondering, for any indie developers who are listening to the cast, could you share with us your thoughts on, you know, using Steam as a platform and as a delivery service for Action Hang?
All right, so let me see. So Steam is a really... working with the platform itself is really easy. Like, it's really, so we don't have any experience with working with consoles or, you know, with the console manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So, but what I do know from, you know, hearing from people and sort of experience, and it's that Steam is really easy about things. Like, it's all up to you, basically. They give you the full control. You can upload your images, you can upload your text, you're in charge of uploading your builds and putting them live, and basically, like, they want you to be in charge of everything, which is nice, because if your game seems to be breaking right before release, you can just still push an update. Whereas if you want to do it on, I don't know, like a console platform, that tends to take a while. So they're just really a lot more strict, whereas Steam is just like, yeah, sure, go ahead, put on there whatever you want. The problem, however, is because they have been getting so much more open and sort of letting people in, it's also a lot harder to stick out with your game, because, I mean, basically, all that Steam cares about is making money, right? That's what the goal of their company is, of course. So if your game sells well, they're going to put you on the front page, which makes it sell even more. But if your game doesn't do that well, then you shouldn't expect to be on the front page. And that's something, well, we learned as well in sort of when we were doing the early access launch. We found out that, you know, nowadays that it's already getting so flooded on Steam that they don't have the time to announce or put effort in every game that launches, because it can be 10 games every day easily. So we found out about that in the hard way. So we were like, oh, wait, we thought we were going to be on the front page and getting all the, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of a learning moment for us. But it obviously it makes perfect sense that they just tend to feature the games that are already doing well. Mm-hmm. So whereas I think if you work with sort of with the console partner, for example, I guess that's more sort of a partnership, and they tend to be more put more curation into what games are allowed on the platform and whatnot. So that's a big difference. On Steam, it's all open and it's everyone for themselves, and if you do well, then they'll help you out as well.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky thing releasing your game on Steam, because the reason we went for a PC game and not, for example, a mobile game is because of the whole sort of saturation problem that the mobile market has. There are so many games coming out there that it's just really hard to, you know, stick your head out there. So we said, well, let's do a PC game then, because then we can just still do sort of a traditional game with, you know, you pay for the game and then you can play it. And well, we came up with that idea a couple of years ago, and by the time we finished the game, it was already getting so busy on Steam that it was not the same thing anymore as when we came up with it. So for Steam, it's also getting, you know, a bit of a problem.
Yep, and again, you're not alone on that settlement role. It seems that we have had that just huge influx of indie developers, not just on Steam, but the mobile market as well. And it is becoming a lot harder to really set yourself apart from everyone else. And
yeah,
I know with the mobile market, there's also that whole issue of how much, you know, games have become devalued over the last 2-3 years. That's getting harder and harder to release an actual, like a retail release on mobile, as opposed to, you know, making your game, you know, free to play with in-app purchases.
Yeah.
And with Steam, it's not as, you know, horrible, but we are seeing some cases where it's getting difficult to, you know, price your game high, as opposed to, you know, people wanting, you know, always on sale. They want to spend, you know, $3-4 on games.
Yeah, it's definitely a tricky thing. I've come to think more of it as like when you're sort of going to start a band with your friends. Like, you're forming a band with your friends, and then your parents, you're like, yeah, you know, it's all in good fun, but don't expect to actually make any money from it, or, you know, do it for a living, because that's only a really small percentage of the people. And I think sort of game development is starting to get that problem too, because it's so, I mean, it's so easy nowadays to make a game. Making a good game is something different. And
yeah.
Sort of, but, you know, just simply making a game is so easy nowadays that it's just, there are so many people doing it. So you have to find a way to differentiate yourself if you want to, you know, do it for a living. But yeah, I guess that's a problem that everyone will face.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And about making yourself stand out, one of the things that we've been seeing over the last year is that it's not just about making a good game anymore. You really need to advertise your game. You need to put it out in front of people. And that's another area where we see a lot of indie developers tend to slip up on is, you know, keeping up with the PR, making sure your game is being constantly updated in terms of news, etc., etc.
Yeah. So I guess for me, that was sort of the point where I went from sort of just making games and having fun to actually, you know, trying to run a game studio. That was the point when I realized that basically having a good game is already... Nowadays, it's standard. Like, you have to have a really good game for starters, and then, you know, but then you're not there yet. So you know, being able to sell the game is also, it's also crucial, which is also why Kitty is working for us, and she's doing marketing for us, and she's reaching out to YouTubers and streamers and the press, and that's how we got in touch. So,
yeah.
So it's really important to have someone either in your team who likes to do marketing, but to, you know, be able to sacrifice basically your job on marketing, because it's not something you can sort of do on the side, or you have to hire someone or find someone who wants to do it. And that's tricky because these groups of game developers tend to be, you know, a bunch of friends who know each other from... you know, IT university or game development schools, and then usually they're just a bunch of developers and they just want to make games, and they don't really care about marketing and all that blah blah. They don't like it, so, and then they sort of forget about it or don't really put much effort into it. Or some guys like, yeah, I'll also take care of the marketing, and he sort of does it on the side, and so. So that's a tricky thing. Yeah, it's something you need to put effort in or find someone who's, you know, has expertise in that.
Yep. And another problem is that, as we said, a lot of indie studios are really just, you know, three or four people getting together to make a game. And if no one in that group knows about PR who wants to do it, then you're left with either, you know, half-assing it or, you know, trying to find someone be your dedicated PR person. And we've seen a lot of developers over the last few years who they don't really deal with PR, or they just wait for the game to come out and then do their PR campaign. And that really doesn't work anymore. You need to have a consistent PR for your title before and after development.
Yeah. I think it's definitely... Well, I think it's just important to see it basically just as important as the game itself. Just, because if you have a great game and no one knows about it, then yeah, then it's not going to sell well. So,
Definitely. Now, going back to Action Hank on Early Access and Steam, in terms of keeping it updated, what was like the frequency that you guys, or what you're still doing in terms of adding new content or releasing new versions of the game onto Steam?
So let's see. When we started out, we set this goal of updating it every 2 weeks. So we did that a bunch of times. So yeah, the first couple of months we updated it every 2 weeks, but that was a bit too much, actually, because we were not really having a sort of a player base that was so huge that they really were keeping up with it, or were like, yeah, they were counting down the days for the next update. So it was not like we had a huge crowd screaming for the next update. And also, it was usually, it takes about a day or maybe 2 days to actually wrap all the loose ends up again and make the game sort of in a releasable state,
mm-hmm.
and build everything and upload it and announce it to everyone, and sort of seeing when you update it, then there's usually something breaks and then you have to fix it, do another update. So it was a bit too much overhead on our part, and it was also a bit too much just stressful because mm-hmm. you have to set these really short deadlines, but some features just take longer than that, and then you have to try to spread them out, but sometimes you have to sort of completely throw around the game, so you can't really sort of start working on it halfway through something.
Mm-hmm.
So after a while, I think a month or three ago, we said, okay, let's just sort of do monthly updates and not do like a set date, but sort of just announce it about a week in advance, like, hey, we're going to do a new update in about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to work better for us. I also discussed it with some other developers, and everyone has their sort of different approach mm-hmm. to it, but I really like it this way, taking about a month and then sort of announcing it about a week in advance. And then that way you can just do bigger chunks of work and you don't have as much overhead and you have less stress as well, because you can sort of properly schedule the work mm-hmm. about a month.
Yeah, and we hear this from other developers who have been trying to keep up with consistent updates for their games, and generally a month an update, I think, is what a lot of people feel acceptable for early access or just these games that have to be constantly updated. Now, when you guys decide to work on whatever your next project is, do you see the studio sticking with staying at 1 month per update, or will you guys try the weekly or every other week at some point in the future?
So like I said, we basically started from 2 weeks and then we went to monthly, and that has been working out really great. So, and I guess earlier on in the project when we were not doing early access, we still did sort of monthly milestones.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these sort of deadlines of a month, they work pretty well. I enjoy them because mm-hmm. they're long enough to actually get some work done, but they're also small enough to be able to sort of grasp the whole thing in your head. You know, you can have a bit of an idea of the whole thing you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, a month is really nice.
Okay. Now, for Action Hang, one topic that I didn't talk about earlier was the actual art style for the game. And I know the game has a pretty unique art style in terms of, you know, the toy figures and having it be in this, you know, world of the figures moving around with the larger actual world behind it. In terms of developing the art for the game, could you talk a little bit about developing the game's unique aesthetic?
Yeah, okay. So, first of all, I'm not an artist or mm-hmm. the art lead or anything. So, but I can tell you about the whole process and about how our art lead, how he came up with the whole thing. So basically, when we started coming up with the idea of the game, we kind of split up, actually, and I sort of came up with this whole idea of the sort of curve-based platforming 2.5D thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I basically said to the guy, I said, well, this is what I want to do, and you can put whatever you like on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then he went thinking about what kind of art style he liked, and he is, so obviously we make 3D art. It's sort of our strength, because not many small studios can do that. But it's also sort of our weakness, because we can only do 3D art, so interface tends to be quite tricky for us.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to go for 3D art style, because that's what we do always. And then he likes to do art he can measure, just sort of measurable things. So he likes to do vehicles and that kind of stuff. But we also like to do colorful and happy stuff, because that's just how we are. We like to do just, you know, vibrant and happy, upbeat games. So that's how we sort of came to the toy world thing, because it's a combination of, it's almost cartoony, colorful, but it's not really cartoony, because it's still realistic, basically. So it's realistic, yet colorful. So that's how the whole story of the, like, how the toys came in there. And then the story about this action figure in a midlife crisis was also, I mean, it was also this whole idea of trying to get a main character that has some kind of personality, rather than this really generic, you know, perfect action hero, because that's how action heroes tend to be. They're like the perfect, muscular, cool guy. And we were like, yeah, what if we sort of give him some character and, you know, make him have some flaws? And that's basically all the characters in the game. They sort of have their own flaws in a way. And we specifically want them to not be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's very interesting about having, like, the characters be, you know, not having that, you know, perfect quality to them. Because we're seeing a lot more discussions these days about developing more realistic characters, as opposed to, you know, just falling back on old and tired tropes for your character designs and just your general game as well.
Yeah.
And definitely great topics that we've had regarding just developing this game. I know, as we said, Rage Squid is really like a new studio for you guys, since you went from working and meeting each other in college to running the studio. Now, for Action Hank in the future, I know we said earlier in the cast that I believe the game has another month or two of development. Is that right?
Yeah. So we are definitely wrapping up the game right now. And we want to basically have it done in about a month, but so we don't really have a release window yet specifically, but I mean, I can tell that we're definitely trying to wrap up the game.
Okay. Now, for the actual game being released, I know it's, of course, on Early Access now. When the game is, quote-unquote, you know, it's all done, it's out of Early Access, are you guys going to change the pricing at all, or is it going to remain at $10?
So we're probably going to increase the price slightly to around $14-$15, something around that. And that was mainly because we wanted to attract new people when we just released it on Early Access, simply because we don't really have an audience or a fan base yet. We are like, hey, if you are willing to, you know, give us the opportunity to, you know, show you this game, we're dropping the price, because you're already willing to invest in us on such an early stage. So yeah, so when we're launching, we're trying to go a bit higher, because the game is actually getting quite a lot more content and also a bunch of other features that we hadn't really necessarily planned on earlier on, such as online multiplayer, and we're also doing a level editor. So yeah, so it's going to be a bit more, like the price is going to be up a little bit.
Yeah. And pricing, as we talked about earlier in terms of PR, pricing is another very sticky point for new developers and even older developers trying to remain viable in today's market. As we've talked about, game devaluation is a major issue. It's really prevalent among the mobile market, and it's sort of escalating among PC. Now, with Action Hang, as we said, in terms of its pricing, did you guys spend a lot of time deciding, you know, what the price was going to be? Or how did you essentially set on the price that you want to charge for the game?
Yeah, so I guess we spent quite some time thinking about the price. But the problem is that in the end, you never know. In the end, it's just a guess.
Yeah.
And you never know what the difference is between making it $10 or $11. Or, I mean, so... In the end, you try to think about everything, and I guess the thing that we really, you know, decided about is like, are we going to make it more expensive now and you know, cheaper in the end, or the same price, or are we going to make it more expensive in the end? So that was the conclusion I told you earlier about, like, people that were willing to invest in us on an early stage. We said, okay, then you should get the game cheaper, because we are really thankful for people for doing that. So that was sort of an sort of easy decision to make, because it made sense to us. But then this deciding the price of the early action and deciding the price of the final game is just, you look at other games and then you look at sort of the amount of content you have and sort of you look at all these kinds of things, and then in the end you just try to come up with a number, and then it sort of you just have to see how it goes. You never know.
Yeah. Now, another part of games that are on Early Access, and especially games being released today, is the expectation for developers to continue working on a project, continuing to expand it. Now, for you guys in Action Hank, when the game is finally finished in the next month or so, do you see yourselves continuing to add content to the game, or do you think you're going to move on to whatever your next project will be?
I think the game is not really set up in a way to sort of keep adding content to it. So we might do some small stuff, But it's not sort of a long-term project that we have in mind. So when it's done, it should sort of be completely done, and then we might add, some sort of funny things for holiday themes or that kind of stuff. But that's just small stuff. We want the game to be sort of done when we release it.
Okay. Now, do you guys have like your next game like sort of in the works at the moment, or is it still too soon to be talking about what's next for Rage Squid?
We try to not think too much about a new game because we want to keep the focus, especially now, because now because we're wrapping up things, we really need to focus now. So we sometimes discuss little ideas, but that's on a really abstract level. Like how about a game where you just, really basic stuff, but that's nothing serious yet. So that will probably be after we release the game, we'll really start thinking about new stuff to do.
Now, I guess to wrap things up, to sort of go on a brief tangent, for you, Roll, what type of games do you generally like to play when you're not busy working on Action Hank?
Let's see. Yeah, well, so I don't really have a specific type of game or thing that I like. I mean, obviously, if there's sort of games like Trials and Super Meat Boy and these sort of hard games that are really have really simple mechanics and that you can sort of get better at the mechanics over time while you play it, I really love those kinds of games. But there's not anything sort of specific that I really like.
Yeah, I guess I'm pretty much the same way. I tend to dabble in a lot of genres these days. And I think for me, I also like games that are, easy to learn, difficult to master type deals. And we see a lot of those with, action or platforming based games where it's more about the player's skill as opposed to, figuring out crazy game systems or dealing with abstract concepts.
Yeah, no, yeah. So and then again, other times I actually enjoy games that where you sort of have these really deep, complex systems. But in general, I tend to, really enjoy those games that are sort of simple, and that's why I guess I tend to play more indie games, because they usually tend to be a bit more like this. Just have a really simple premise, and then they try to, get as much gameplay out of a simple mechanic as possible. So if you build it correctly, you can get a lot of depth and a lot of learning curve into a simple mechanic.
Yep. And this is another great topic that we've talked about several times on the podcast over the last few months about getting that core foundation of your game, getting that perfected and then building up around that, as opposed to going with the kitchen sink approach of, saying, let's just add all these different mechanics in and then see what works, as opposed to saying, okay, let's focus on one really great thing, and then if that comes out perfect, then let's build around that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree on that. I think if your core and then especially in games that are based around motion, such as platformer games or racing games, or if moving around is your main thing, then that should be already perfect by itself. Like it should be a fun game even without any sort of goal or targets or just moving around. Because if moving around already is fun to do without any goal, then you can just sort of add some player steering and some player direction to it. Like, hey, what if you beat this level in this time? Or what if you jump this high?
Definitely.
That just, yeah, that if your core mechanic is flawed, the moving, the motion, if it's sort of flawed, then nothing is going to be fun because you're going to be frustrated throughout the whole game.
That flow of movement and control, especially with action games, is very important. I know we could spend, another hour to just discuss good control design, good movement flow in 2D titles. And another part of this, as we just said, in terms of creating that foundation, is, really coming up with a good 5 to 10 minutes of gameplay, figuring out what that engagement is for your title, and making sure that works. Because if you can get someone hooked within like the first 5 to 10 minutes, then they're going to keep coming back for more, as opposed to, saying the game doesn't start for another 3 hours of tutorials and stuff
Yeah,
like
and the whole
that.
storyline you have to get into, and yeah, no, like I said earlier on, it's we want the people to get what the game is about in the first level, and so in the first 30 seconds. So so that they already realize, hey, this is fun. And if they're hooked, then they just they keep on playing. And then they, okay, one more level. Yeah, okay, after this, one more. That's just, yeah. And that means then you're hooked. So people tend to play either one or two levels, or they, you know, keep playing throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think with that, I have just one last question for you, Roel, and then we will begin to wrap things up. And as we talked about over the cast with Action Hank and developing the time trial gameplay, developing the movement, the flow, now, for the actual levels themselves, what type of approach did you and your team work at in terms of developing each level and basically challenging the player in different ways?
So basically, so the first sort of half of the game, most of the levels are built by me. Mm-hmm. And there's also, we have a level design intern, and he's doing a whole bunch of other levels, which mostly are going to be for sort of the second part of the game, mm-hmm. which is not released yet. And what we try to do is we try to really sort of calculate all the possibilities that players have in terms of motion. So we actually, I built this tool to sort of predict where the player is going to end up based on what their velocities are and based on sort of inputs they can do at certain moments. So you basically create this sort of motion for the player where you say, okay, at this point I want the player to slide, and here I want him to jump, and here I want him to whatever. And then you add some sort of randomness to it, whereas because some people forget to slide or they don't know that they should jump there, or so you add some randomness to the input, also in terms of timing, because everyone, some people are more precise and some people are slower. And then you let the physics simulation run, like you let it simulate for a couple hundred times, and then you basically get this beautiful arc of all the possibilities that can happen to a player. No matter how good or bad they are, you can see how they will end up. And then you try to space all the landing blocks. And there's also, you know, a lot of points in the game, you have different heights, like different paths you can take. And then it's a matter of spacing everything in a way that no matter what the player does, they will always land in a nice sort of downward slope where they feel like they're going nicely with the flow and they can keep their momentum. Mm-hmm. And then to have these sort of different paths have different timing. So the sort of the best path, which is usually the top one, has to be the shortest one, and then the others have to be a bit longer. Mm-hmm. But that's basically, so there's basically a lot of actual just simulation and calculation involved in spacing these jumps. But the result of that is that, especially in the early levels, people tend to feel like they're really good at the game, no matter if they're just starting out or if they're already experts at it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And as we said earlier in the cast, with the different ghost difficulty settings, you can have players of different skill levels enjoy the game, but they don't have to, you know, play the game at the rainbow, you know, the super hardest ghost to get an enjoyment out of Action Hank.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, so with that said, we're going to wrap things up. My final question for you, Roel, is for your fans listening, do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to end the cast with?
Oh, that's a tough question. I don't know. Just make games and have fun and don't take everything too seriously.
Definitely words to live by for a lot of indie developers.
Yeah.
So with that, we can wrap things up. Roel, it was definitely a pleasure talking today, and Action Hank does feel like a very interesting title from the speedrunning and more of a platforming angle compared to other titles, and I can't wait to see how the game turns out when it's actually released in the next month or so.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep, not a problem. Hopefully, when things are less busy, I know with GDC coming up and the game release, hopefully we can have you guys back on for, you know, an up-to-date podcast or just talking about other design-related topics.
Yeah, sounds good.
Awesome. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options currently available. For guest pieces or being a future guest on the podcast, you can find that information and links under Submissions Wanted. And we are, of course, looking for additional developers for our roundtable discussions, which will be happening throughout 2015. And you can email me through the same links there. And lastly, to contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure monthly funding for Game Wisdom, you can find all the information for that under the Patreon banner, also on the front page. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.
See ya.